You're listening to County Conversations, a podcast brought to you by the New York State Association of Counties. This episode is a special edition in our coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic. The interview series features county officials who represent the range of functions counties serve at the local level. This episode features a conversation on addressing food insecurity in New York City. NYSAC's Executive Director, Stephen Aquario, is joined by Catherine Garcia, the city's Commissioner of Sanitation and Food Czar during the COVID-19 pandemic. They discuss the logistics of emergency food distribution, using technology in innovative ways, and leveraging lessons learned during the pandemic for long-term planning.
And welcome to today's podcast. I'm joined with Catherine Garcia, of New York City, the New York City Food Czar, amongst other titles that Commissioner Catherine Garcia holds or has held. My name is Stephen Aquario. I'm the Executive Director of the New York State Association of Counties. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. So, Catherine, you have extensive experience in New York City, born and bred there, worked there all your life, worked so hard for the people of New York City, for the residents that come in to this city, enjoy this city, the tourists that come into this city, all benefit from your great work. You have extensive management experience. You've worked at the New York City Housing Authority, New York City Sanitation Department. You've helped clear roads from extensive weather conditions. You've addressed lead prevention for children, helped with water, drinking water, wastewater. You are a remarkable individual.
Thank you. I should feel more tired.
You have extensive experience in New York City. Is that why Mayor Bill de Blasio tapped you in the early stages of a very serious global public health crisis, a pandemic? Is that why Mayor de Blasio tapped you to be the food czar, as it's been called, during the early stages of this pandemic?
I mean, that would be what I would presume. I didn't ask him at the time what his rationale was, but it was very clear that we were going to have to stand up a large organization to achieve the goal that he wanted achieved, which is to make sure that people did not go hungry. And so that is one of the things I was a little surprised. I have never worked on food or health and human services, but it really ended up being very much a logistics and operational job.
Well, to me, it's clear why he chose you. You are an accomplished individual, a very successful individual, a motivated individual, a thoughtful individual. So early on, Mayor de Blasio made it a priority. This is not something mandated by a city charter or mandated by a state law, a local law. Mayor de Blasio, the city of New York, made a decision early on in this pandemic when, let's be frank here, there was total chaos in New York City, in New York State. We were the epicenter of this pandemic. The city, the mayor, made an early decision to, quote, feed people. And that he did that decision, made that decision, you executed that decision because it was the right thing to do. Can you tell us about in the early stages of this pandemic when, of course, schools were shut down? That is where a million children on any given day in the city of New York would have received their meals. What did it mean to make a decision to feed people because the schools were now shut down? You had older adults and families that were in need of food. Can you tell us about that early decision and what it was like when it happened?
So the way that I recall it, it was a very chaotic time back in March, where our understanding of what was happening was changing very rapidly from this is going to be contained to no, this is spreading very, very, very rapidly. And the amount of fear and anxiety that was happening at that point around people's health. And so I think that one of the things that came out of that is clearly healthcare was going to be a massive priority, but making sure that people were fed ended up being a priority in part because of the way we had to fight the virus, which means sheltering in place. And that changes the dynamic of how you would normally do emergency food distribution. You know, the core of regular emergency food distribution is through food pantries, through soup kitchens. But in this case, we didn't want anyone to go out. And so the whole thinking around food had to change. But it was very clear that we did not want people to be going hungry, and we had to have completely new models to make sure that that did not happen.
Let's talk about some of the numbers here. We mentioned, or I mentioned, that there's 1 million children on any given day. How did you come to understand and appreciate the amount of people which needed to be fed? We're starting to see situations across the United States today, June 15th, 22 states now, with things starting to spike up. If things get out of control and hospitalizations are surging around the United States in big cities like Los Angeles or Miami or Chicago, what advice do you have for them on trying to appreciate and come to understand the amount of people which will need to be fed, and how did you interact with the various food pantries? In New York City, you mentioned food pantries and soup kitchens. This is really related to a particular neighborhood. There are not-for-profits in any given neighborhood, but New York City is a neighborhood of neighborhoods, and food pantries and food banks are all independent silos, perhaps, serving an area of a borough of New York, a particular neighborhood of New York. Maybe it's through a church or a religious entity that might help serving. How did you possibly come to appreciate the amount of people who needed to be fed, and how did you interact and manage your way around all these individual food pantries?
So we set up sort of a multi-prong system, and food pantries is just one leg of that stool. And I did come to understand that these were very independent organizations. And usually in times that are not quite as chaotic as the pandemic, are very, very reliant on volunteers who are older. And when it became clear that they would have to shelter in place, many food pantries did not have enough volunteers to stay open. So there are about 800 food pantries in the city of New York. There are several large umbrella organizations such as City Harvest and Food Bank and United Way and Catholic Charities and Met Council. But there are also really varying amounts of capacity with any of these food pantries. And so we have worked very hard, one, to push resources in their direction, both public resources, but also working with the philanthropic sector within the city of New York to make sure they understood what we were seeing on the ground and where they could use their philanthropic dollars to fill in some of those gaps. So we were having lots of conversations on both sides with our city council to use city resources, as well as with the philanthropic sector, to make sure that we were getting food out into communities as fast as possible and seeing really high numbers, people who had never gone to a food pantry before needing access. And so another piece of this was about creating some technology tools so that you could easily find the nearest food pantry, because one of the other things we didn't want people to do was travel a lot. And so we wanted them to be able to find it in their local neighborhood. The other thing we also, is part of that process, was where do we need to actually add sort of food pantry pop-ups in neighborhoods that are not covered by more traditional pantries, where there are sort of geographical gaps. So that is one of the pieces. But it is one of several different things that we did in terms of distributing food and then delivering food.
We're talking with Commissioner Catherine Garcia, and our topic is today on food insecurity. Commissioner, can you define that term for those who may not be familiar with food insecurity? What does that mean to you? What does that mean to the city of New York?
So food insecurity, what it means is that people don't know where their next meal is coming from. They either don't have the funds to buy anything, and so they literally don't know when they are going to eat again. And we think that the number of food insecure people in the city of New York has basically doubled from its pre-COVID-19 to today. And one of the things that we had to figure out, particularly for seniors who were being asked to shelter in place and might have gone to a senior center and gotten food during the day, was how are we going to get food to them? And that ends up being, at this point in time, we're delivering about 1 million meals a day to that population and to those people who are sick with COVID or recovering or quarantined to make sure that people can eat.
Well, in the middle of this pandemic, we had a hospitalization surge. We had a healthcare system that did not collapse, but we had a surge on the use of the hospitalization, the beds, the intensive care units, ventilators. It was remarkable, the efforts by the city, by the mayor, by you, to stand up a response for food insecurity during the pandemic. Obviously, there's no precedent for the scale of what you did. What have been some of the greatest challenges and opportunities that you may have learned through this process? I'll give you an interesting, I'll remind you of an interesting thing that you told me during this crisis, and it was a crisis, and you did respond to that crisis. You told me that you've come to understand some of the food preferences of New Yorkers, and in particular, some of the seafood preferences of New Yorkers. Of course, we all have a diet that we like certain foods. Can you share with our listeners what you learned about the food preferences of New Yorkers?
Sure. So beyond making sure there was emergency food available to people who were hungry, we were very closely tracking the supply chain all across the country, how many trucks are coming into the city of New York. And much of the fish that comes into the city of New York, 90% of it goes to restaurants. The things that we like to purchase in a grocery store are salmon, tilapia, shrimp, but we don't tend to want the swordfish steak necessarily from our local Stop and Shop or grocery store associated, whatever you may shop at. And so it was not prepared for us to end up taking it. And we saw some various, many people saw across the country, a lot of both buying much, much more shelf-stable products, pasta, canned goods, but also baking. We had a lot of struggle with flour in the city of New York because everyone started, you know, baking us because they were home. And really cooking more because they were home, and most restaurants were only doing takeout or delivery. And many were closed during the height of this. And so as people hunkered down, the way that they ate, the way that New Yorkers ate, changed.
This is an important conversation right now, right here on this topic, because COVID-19 is an example of a virus that attacked the world. Certainly, there's other things that could attack humans at any given point in time, whether it's a virus or an act of war or a natural disaster. We don't know what's coming, and a lot of the things that you put in place and that you learned and that you observed during the COVID-19 pandemic are certainly applicable to protecting us as we go forward into other things that might come our way. Let's talk a little bit more about what you just said, about the connection to the restaurant industry and the relationship of the grocery industry and the differences between the two. Now, a regional supply chain must be a massive undertaking for the restaurant industry alone. But what you've come to understand is that regional food supply chain was connected to the restaurants and not necessarily, which were closed. Many of them were closed, subject to takeout orders only. But what you came to find out is that a regional supply chain was not necessarily connected to the grocery store where people needed to get food. What can we learn from this? What can be done to create a stronger local supply chain, either to support or connect the upstate farming community in New York State, the agriculture producers, both produce and meats from upstate or in the region to the city of New York? And as a follow-up to that type of a question, Commissioner, shouldn't the city have a meat processing plant within the city proper? And are there areas of cold storage for the production of such meat?
Yeah, thank you for that question, because it is one of the things that we were looking at, as everyone was, when particularly the meat processing plants became hotspots. Is that the grocery stores are really national supply chains that are going to very big distributors. And the more regional farmers were connected into the restaurant. And there's about 40% of the food coming into the city of New York. So we are thinking about, in the longer term, what do we need to do to make it so that we're more agile? So many of the big distributors who distributed to restaurants began creating home delivery options. And I have to say, I think they like them better because residents pay immediately, unlike restaurants that tend to pay you when they get the bill. And we created a matching system between suppliers and distributors who might not know each other because they just did it, worked in sort of two silos of the food system, and so that they can go online and make some matches that way. But we all are really thinking about what can we do more regionally, what can we have closer to the city, because the traditional butchers, there's still a few of them left in the city of New York, had no issues with their supply chain because they get whole animals from within our region, and there was no challenges for them. It was really coming from these national processing locations where we struggled. And as I think about, you know, we were consistently getting whole chickens in, but there were moments where, for example, the supply of chicken breasts wasn't coming in because we just had not processed the food, or, you know, chicken nuggets. Some of the more processed food was not getting into the city because there had been reductions in supply because people were getting sick. But I think that we're really looking at what we can do both as a purchaser, as the city of New York, and what we can do to facilitate businesses like that in the city of New York. It is very challenging. We do not have very much cold storage in the city, and obviously land is always at a premium. But how can we incentivize that to occur is something we're very much engaged on.
Well, it certainly sounds like you've discovered something of interest to the people of New York, and that is ensuring a proper food supply chain, a chain of distribution to grocers, to the restaurant industry, and the combination of the two during a crisis, very important. It's a commodity. It's like gasoline. If there's an issue with the ports, if there's an issue with where folks get gasoline during a crisis, that's going to become in limited supply, and so too will food. So the work that you have done and are doing will benefit immeasurably New Yorkers today and those that come tomorrow. Let's talk a little bit about long-range planning with food supply chains. we've seen spikes in farm workers in rural communities across the country. It's not limited to urban areas. This virus can spike up anywhere. And we talked about hot spots and food processing, and Tyson Foods, I believe, was affected, some meat processors. Is the city concerned about supply chain impacts? Are you talking with grain producers perhaps now for long-range planning? The city must have a tremendous amount of purchasing power, which it could leverage to ensure good pricing for long-range planning. Is that on your mind?
Absolutely. So we are definitely thinking about how to use the city dollars to make sure that farmers plant, that these things actually occur as we're moving forward. And so it's also looking at, because we are actually not that dependent on any particular distributor, who was really solid during this period, who struggled more, and the fact that the linchpin in all of this is trucking. And how do you make sure that the truckers are still willing to come to a location that may be considered more dangerous than another location, and what can we do to be supportive of them? But we are trying to wrap this into something so that we can document and ensure that people know going forward, here's our long-term plan, here's what we've learned. You know, and on the food delivery side, it was also, how do we leverage the big catering halls in the city of New York to make food and then use taxi drivers to do the delivery? So what are your resources that you have, and how can you be very agile about what could they do?
Excellent tips. Very innovative during the crisis. What broke my heart during the COVID-19 pandemic, and many things did, the loss of life, the loss of our world as we knew it during that pandemic. But one thing that was very disheartening to me was to read about a story in upstate New York. I think it may have been in Cortland County. I'm not sure, in central New York area, where milk was destroyed. Good milk that could have been used for good purposes was dumped. Many gallons, I don't know how many, but quite a bit was destroyed. It seems to me that upstate could be better connected to the city with food distribution and food channels. When the schools were closed, the supply was oversupplied to the demand in upstate New York, and it seems to me that that was a lost opportunity to help the people of New York City. It is one state, and we all want to take care of each other. Do you see future conversations between the upstate dairy, the upstate meat and produce manufacturers as part of these discussions?
Right, you're absolutely correct. There was a major mismatch between supply and demand for milk, which is probably the most difficult commodity to try and match quickly because of how perishable it is. When schools and other institutions closed, there just was not the demand for milk that we had usually or were accustomed to. But definitely we are thinking much more long-term around how do we make these matches to the farming community in upstate New York so that food regionally is invested in and that we are supporting that as we move forward.
Commissioner, you've been very good with your time, and we're so grateful that you can share your experience with folks from in New York State and around the United States, perhaps the world, that may listen to this conversation. Just a couple of other questions I wanted to ask. Really, one more question, and then I'll let you have the last word. The last question I had was, you had to quickly pivot as a city of almost 9 million people, just shy of 10 million people, in a very small, dense area land-wise in this New York City in the five boroughs of New York. You had to convert from feeding children. You mentioned feeding a million children on any given day. You had to pivot quickly during the crisis to serve those that needed meals, older adults, families, seniors. The Older Americans Act, it seems to be underfunded. the Older Americans Act provides funding for senior meals, Meals on Wheels, ways to feed older Americans. It seems like we have an opportunity here before the United States Congress adjourns that they address a follow-up stimulus piece of legislation to help offset local government expenditures related to COVID, to help offset local government revenue losses and sales tax in the tourism industry. But so, too, is there an opportunity to properly fund the Older Americans Act in this piece of legislation, which hopefully can be taken up by the Congress and signed into law by the President. Can you explain why that's important?
So there are many good things in the HEROES Act around food, expansion of SNAP benefits, and things like that, but there isn't actually a lot for senior nutrition. It's about $20 million nationally. But seniors are our most vulnerable during this pandemic, and we want to make sure that they do not have a crisis of hunger in addition to a crisis of health. But it is a strain on local resources to provide what morally we should be providing to these people when at this point in time we have very, very little revenue coming in and huge expenses around health care going out or unemployment insurance or any of these things that are sort of needing to move through local governments. And so, you know, my concern would be without fully funding senior nutrition, that local governments won't be able to provide what I think is essential to these people who are at home and may not have access to food at this time. And, you know, we've been able to leverage the schools for people who are more mobile and use those to feed many, many hundreds of thousands of people. But, you know, this is really where I think we need to make sure that the federal government comes through for the state and local governments, because otherwise across the country people will go hungry.
We've been talking with Commissioner Catherine Garcia, the commissioner of the New York City Department of Sanitation, but also New York City's food czar, appointed by Mayor Bill de Blasio to help address food insecurity during the COVID-19 pandemic. Last word, Commissioner, last word to you about the message that you want to give other jurisdictions around the United States or in the state of New York, smaller cities, that any messages that you want to give, any takeaways that you've learned as we went through this crisis, as you begin to reassemble the city government administration, as we begin to return to work here, lessons learned that might be helpful for Miami, lessons learned for Los Angeles, lessons learned for big cities in Chicago, but the small cities and the small towns of America. We are all united in one way or another, and that we're all Americans. Something that you would like to leave behind as a takeaway.
So I think as we've gone through the pandemic and the inequality and the poverty that has come along with that as people lost their jobs, is that food becomes extremely critical to people and sort of creates another level of desperation if you can't feed people. But you as a local government may have more resources than you know, and I'm not talking about money, but like the person who can really do great organizational stuff and identify who needs help, that you might have taxi drivers who could be repurposed for things, that you might have your school cafeterias that can be used for producing food, that your restaurant industry could be re-stood up to help and assist with this, and to be really creative across different agencies that may have different talents, because the Food Czar team, which is, and it really is a broad team, is people from the Department of Environmental Protection, the mayor's office, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Sanitation. You know, there's a broad range of people who have come together to focus on this mission. And you as a local municipality probably have talent across your local government that you can tap to help put this together?
Catherine Garcia, a true, dedicated public servant, defining what it means to serve the public, not just during a time of crisis, but just during regular, ordinary life. Very grateful for you to share what you've learned during the COVID-19 pandemic, and also grateful for all that you do for the people of New York City and the people of New York. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for tuning into our podcast. If you have any questions for the NYSAC staff pertaining to COVID-19 or have any best practices to share with other counties in the state, please send them to coronavirus@nysac.org.